Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest serial adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann is with me now. Ms. Jones, good day to you.
Good day to you, Michael. How's it going?
Well, it's going very well, but, you know, things are going better in your life than mine, because since we last spoke to our millions of listeners and since I last communicated with you, you have actually done something remarkable that nobody else I know has done for the last year. You've been out and about in town, not very far from Fleet Street. You've met a few old mates from the newspaper world and the communications industry, and you've actually had one of those great long lunches. I hope it went on for at least 14 hours.
It was fantastic. We went to the Bleeding Heart on Hatton Garden. Do you remember that place?
Yeah, I do.
So it's, well, obviously they've got an indoors, but this courtyard is completely outside. One of those old cobbled courtyards off
the jewellery industry location.
It's a fantastic place. Yeah. They were really geared up for it. Great big red umbrellas outside, all the tables and chairs all set up.
Yeah.
And so we decided, because we couldn't find a pub that was open, and David Hancock went and did a recce a few days before. This was how important it was to all get together, you see, but there were no pubs around because, as you rightly said last podcast, there are no pubs in the city open right now because they don't have any outdoor space.
Yeah.
So we couldn't find a pub, so we decided to rock up there a bit early. So we had table for three, we arrived at 2:30. They anticipated that we would do this because we were an old Fleet Street bunch, and they put us a little table on the street that we couldn't sit at, but we could all stand around and have some bottles of wine and, you know, get stuck in before we sat down to lunch. So that was great. So there were six of us. Good old
You couldn't find a pub. The Bleeding Heart is a pub, isn't it?
No, it's a restaurant.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've only ever been there in a drink capacity. It's purely a restaurant. Oh, I see. Right, yeah. Okay.
So it's a French restaurant, very, very high quality food that we had, you know, wonderful meal. But the whole point of it was the get-together of old friends. And we were saying, actually, there aren't many industries in which journalists who used to work together over 30 years ago have stayed friends and still get together on a regular basis. And we still trot out the same old stories and laugh at the same stuff. And there is a shorthand among journalists, especially those of us who worked together during the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, that was a time pre-internet, pre-mobile phones, pre-technology, when we all did it with boots on the ground, getting on planes and going and knocking on doors. That's how we conducted our job in those days.
Yes,
so the war stories are from those eras, and it was highly entertaining. I've never laughed so much, I don't think, since the last time. It was great fun.
It sounds wonderful. Now, one of the people you were with was an old friend of mine, but a much bigger friend of yours, John Blake. And John Blake, for the benefit of our millions of listeners, was a very successful Fleet Street journalist. I think he started the Bizarre column, didn't he, in the London Evening News? And then that was bought out by The Sun. He went there and worked on it there. John ended up as the editor of The People, if I recall. And then after a very successful Fleet Street career, he went into publishing, created John Blake Publishing, and produced many, many very successful books.
Including Katie Price's series of books.
He was the first one ever. John told me that she made a million from him doing her life story the first time round. I read just yesterday that Katie Price is on her seventh autobiography now.
It's great. I mean, you would think, wouldn't you, that she'd run out of stuff to say. But then I think we all watched that recent television documentary about her son, Harvey, and the rigmarole she has to go through to get him treatment and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I was thinking at the time, here comes the next book, which is all about Harvey and the shameful scenario she finds herself in with regard to never having had any support from Harvey's father.
It's shocking, isn't it? Now, apart from that, of course, John also published a book which will live long in the annals of sports reporting, sports journalism, sports books. And that book was called Rooney Tunes. Can you remind our millions of listeners, please, who the author of that one was?
Well, it was your good self, Michael Parry. I think
of course
you co-wrote that with Wayne Rooney, didn't you?
Well, I didn't actually. I didn't because he didn't have anything to do with it. What? I don't know if you spoke to John about it over lunch, but...
I did jog his memory, yes, and he did laugh his head off.
What do you mean, laugh his head off? He should have sort of been on his knees, bowing, you know, in awe.
No, he laughed because it was such a big success. And
he
was enjoying the fact that I was reminding him of it.
Exactly. The story behind it is that there'd been a load of books around on Wayne Rooney, because Wayne Rooney had been a phenomenon at the 2004 championships in Portugal. If Wayne Rooney hadn't broken his metatarsal in the quarterfinal against Portugal, England would have won that tournament without a shadow of a doubt, OK? He was a phenomenon. He scored two goals in the second game, two goals in the third game. He was just a force of nature, and he absolutely smashed open, the access to world football. Now, that summer, he left Everton at 18 years of age, went to Manchester United, became a superstar by scoring a hat-trick in his debut for Manchester United, a European game against a Turkish team. And then came 2006, the World Cup. So I went to John and said, look, all these books on Wayne Rooney. I said, why don't I do one which is slightly tongue-in-cheek called Rooney Tunes? He said, brilliant, let's do it. And it was all about, you know, his childhood and how he's going to be the first billionaire footballer and how the world had responded to him. And I'd got a load of cartoons done, and it was going to be a great book. And then, blow me down, 6 weeks before the World Cup in Germany in 2006, Wayne Rooney broke his metatarsal again. Well, he didn't break it. It was broken for him at Chelsea. Chelsea defender tackled him. He went down. And unfortunately, Wayne missed the start of the tournament. And for that reason, the book flopped. England didn't do terribly well during 2006. We only got to the quarterfinals again. And I'm afraid the book disappeared in a puff of smoke. But it would have been... literally would have been a bestseller had Wayne Rooney done what we thought he was going to do and become leading scorer in that tournament. So the fickle hand of fate, I'm afraid, grabbed us there. But there we are. You know all about writing very successful books, Miss Jones, so you will empathise with my plight.
Well, I completely do. But, you know, I'm surprised to hear you say that because I didn't remember that story. I do remember the book, yeah, which means that it must have crossed my radar at some time back then. Yeah. I think maybe it was a bit short-sighted of the publisher to not have gone ahead with it because...
Oh, no, it went ahead. It went ahead, yeah. But we weren't able to float it on Rooney becoming the greatest footballer in the world, which we thought was what was going to happen at Germany in 2006. I tell you, wrote the first book on Rooney, a fellow Fleet Street colleague of yours and mine, Sue Everson. Do you remember Sue?
Oh, right. Yes, I do, yeah.
Yeah, and what was, Sue got access to Colleen because you'll remember when Wayne Rooney first met Colleen, who is now, of course, world famous as, you know, Colleen Rooney, mother of four and in litigation with Jamie Vardy.
Rebecca Vardy, yeah.
That's right, wife, yeah. When Wayne first met her and Wayne was playing for Everton, Colleen was still in the school play on the Friday night. He went to see her. I mean, that's how young they were when they met, you know. And Sue got access to Colleen and her family and Wayne came around and she wrote the first ever book on the two of them and got to know them very well. So on the basis of that, we thought, well, it's time for another Rooney book. But anyway, there we go. So there we are, Miss Jones. I have to say, I'm rather glad that... the Duke of Edinburgh has been laid to rest now, and without showing any disrespect whatsoever, perhaps the newspapers can start filling up with other things now. Even this morning, 2 days after the funeral, half of the front of all the papers are still full of the Duke of Edinburgh, and I think it's being overdone now.
I'm dismayed. I woke up this morning early, get to the papers, you know. Yep. Surely we've got some new news now. No, we haven't. It's still all about the Duke of Edinburgh. Yeah. And I'm sick of it. I'm sick to death. I didn't watch it live because I was out to lunch, as it were. Yeah. But I did have a look at it. There was a sort of recap version, an omnibus version of it that Hugh Edwards presented on Saturday night. So I did have a look at that. But I just thought, you know, I should, because we did, in fact, have a minute silence. Everybody at the restaurant stood up and we had the minute silence.
Very good. Well done.
At 3 o'clock on Saturday.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I'm done now. You know, how much more can they tell us? What other information can they possibly bring to this story that we haven't yet read?
No, I totally agree with all of that. I stood to attention at 3 o'clock, like you. I thought, well, it's a moment of respect, and then, you know, we're done, and that's fine. I mean, the stretch that the papers are making to find a new line on it, I thought was exemplified in its ridiculousness yesterday when I read a story that said the people who made the coffin for the Duke of Edinburgh, you know, the casket, as they call it in America, are world famous because they made Freddie Mercury's coffin. And I thought, what? What kind of a story is this? What kind of a link is that? I mean, you know more about Freddie Mercury than almost anybody on the planet, but do you really care who made his coffin?
Well, they're really dredging the barrel here, aren't they? This was in the Mail on Sunday, this story. The makers of the coffin for the Duke of Edinburgh is Henry Smith. Yeah. They've made coffins for thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, including Jimi Hendrix and Diana Dawes. Yeah. And we got to read that the Duke of Edinburgh's casket, as they call it, was lead-lined. Well, it has to be lead-lined because it's going into a vault. Yeah. But Freddie Mercury's oak coffin was not lead-lined. I can tell you that because he was cremated. And I know where his ashes are buried too. But I mean, really, do we need to, isn't this rather undignified? Do we need to know this stuff? That isn't a connection. That is a little journalist running around going, I need a news story on the Duke of Edinburgh. It's all been said. Oh, I know. I'll go and check out the funeral directors and see who made the coffin. Yeah. It's a little bit distasteful, I think.
I think so as well, honestly. I think it's tawdry, and I didn't enjoy reading that. I enjoy reading most things that are in newspapers, but I certainly didn't enjoy reading that. Now, Ms. Jones, since we last spoke, our respective teams have played each other, Everton Spurs, Friday night, 2-2 draw. Disappointing from my point of view, disappointing from Spurs' point of view. But can I tell you that my concentration on that game was disturbed by the fact that a couple of hours earlier, completely out of the blue, I suddenly read a tweet from Damian Lewis to announce that his wife, the absolutely fantastic actress, Helen McCrory, had died suddenly of cancer. Well, she hadn't died suddenly. She'd been ill for quite a while, but nobody had been told. And I have to say, it shook me to my boots. One of my favourite TV series ever is Peaky Blinders, and she played Auntie Poll, you know, the matriarch of the Shelby clan in that. And I was devastated to learn that the poor woman had died. I mean, really, really felt for her and felt touched by the loss of such a beautiful woman.
I completely understand why she kept it a secret. One of her friends said, look, she wanted to be alive while she was still alive and not waiting to die, which the media would have made of it. You know, it would have been how many months, how many weeks, how much time has she got left, all of that. And the focus would have gone on to her death before she'd even got there. You know, we all face this. We're all waiting to die in a way. We just don't know when. Yeah, and sure. I think especially the mother of two relatively young children.
She's 14, I think, yeah.
Yeah, early teens. That's a very difficult age. Any age is difficult to lose one's mother. Yeah. But that is a terrible age for kids to have to go through that. And so she would have had them at the front of her mind and protecting them from all the publicity and exposure. And they dealt with it in a dignified way as a family. And she allowed her husband it was a mercy to him, really, wasn't it? To be able to announce it in his own time when he felt he could face it. Yeah. And he did a wonderful thing there. She also said to him, according to him, that he should go out and get as many girlfriends as he could after she died.
Yeah, I saw that.
So, that, you know, a lot of dignity, a lot of elegance, a lot of ferocity in that woman. And that would have kept her going probably for quite a bit longer than she would otherwise have had left.
No, I totally agree. I mean, when we've all written stories, you know, we've written thousands of stories over the years and all that, and you always look back on them and think, could I have done that better? Did I miss this? Did I spot that? 3 weeks before she died, she was doing a TV interview for something to do with a charity she supported. And the female presenter, and I think it was Kate Garraway, but I'm not certain. So, Kate, if it wasn't you, I'm sorry, said to her, oh, are you all right, Helen? Because she started coughing, right? You know, like everybody does occasionally when you're in live broadcasting and all that. And she just sort of shook her head and said, yes, fine, I'm all right. What the interviewer didn't know was that if the answer had been, no, I'm sorry, I've got terminal cancer, it would have been a completely different story. I mean, it's honestly the fickle hand of fate, eh?
Well, and, you know, you've got to hand it to Helen to not use that opportunity to announce it to the world.
Yeah, sure.
She was stignified to the last, wasn't she, Anne?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm very impressed by that because she made it not about her. She made it about her family.
No, I totally agree with you. Now, Ms. Jones, as you are one of the world's leading rock star biographers, what do you make of this sudden slurry of books on Bob Dylan? I mean, I've never really been a great Dylan fan. I don't know an awful lot about him. I know that the Beatles apparently were introduced to marijuana by Bob Dylan when they went to America. But why are people suddenly writing books about Bob Dylan now? He's not died. He was in the Traveling Wilburys. I mean, what's the story here?
Well, it's a very obvious hook. He's about to turn 80 years old.
Right.
On the 24th of May, which is also my brother's birthday, you know, nice connection there.
Yeah.
He's about to turn 80, which is always an excuse for a retrospective, isn't it? One of those big hooks that they hang these kind of books on. There's a guy called Clinton Halen. He's written one of them, The Double Life of Bob Dylan, in which he exposes all Bob Dylan's fibbing over the years. But get this, he's written 11 previous Dylan-based books. 11. And this new
When's your second book on John Lennon coming out then?
Well, you know, I'm beginning to think that maybe I should be planning that now. But this Double Life of Bob Dylan is 500 plus pages, and it only takes the story up to 1966. So, you know, I'm exhausted at the thought of even going out and buying that, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. When people start writing books in chronicles like that, I think Alistair Campbell is now literally on his seventh book of diaries, you know. And Ali's a big mate of mine, you know, and I've known him for years since Fleet Street and all that. But he just can't stop writing about, you know, the life he's had in journalism and in politics. And I have to say, every word he writes is very interesting, but I don't think I could stand, you know, seven books on Bob Dylan, John Lennon, or anybody else.
You've got to be a really big fan, haven't you? And I have wondered about Alistair's books, actually. Has the moment not passed for those? Or have we come through that era and out the other side? Are we really that interested in the Blair years anymore?
You know, it's a very good question, and I don't think we are. But I'm more interested in Ali's perspective of it, you see what I mean? But you're absolutely right. But you've got to remember also that Ali's a very complicated man. He's had, you know, terrible mental health issues all his life. He gets deep depressions. He can't get out of bed sometimes for 2 or 3 days. So he's got to have a reason to get out of bed. Do you see what I mean? And one of those reasons is, you know, I've got more to say to the world. I remember him saying after he left Downing Street, where he was effectively running the country, he was chief advisor and head of the sort of communications machinery in Downing Street and Whitehall. He was effectively running the country, advising Tony Blair. And I remember when he left, and he left because he'd become the story instead of dishing out the stories, he said, "I'm not sure if I will ever do anything worthwhile again for the rest of my life. So powerful and so all-consuming was my role in Downing Street." And he's had, you know, years to have to battle with that sort of vacuum.
Yeah, he was the original Dominic Cummings, wasn't he?
Oh, he
really,
without
the scandal.
Yes, he was. Yeah, no, I totally agree.
I mean, you'd have to say that Alice was a good guy and still is. You know, and he kept his head and he also kept his humility. I've run into him at a couple of things over the years since, and he'll always come over and give you a kiss on the cheek and buy you a beer and that kind of stuff. You know, he's not grand, where so many of them have become so.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Anyway, getting back to rock stars, Bob Dylan and all that, have you ever thought about writing a book on Elvis? I don't suppose you have, because he died virtually before you were born, so to speak. But again, you know, I look back on these things and don't realise, you know, the way things have happened. I was flicking through the channels the other night and I came to, it must have been Sky Documentaries or something like that, and they were doing the Elvis story from the start. I didn't know that when Elvis started, he used to front a band with a guitar in his hand and he was very good at playing the guitar. And I thought, no, it must just be a prop, you know, a bit like Wham, you know, when Andrew Ridgely used to sort of float around with a guitar in his hand, you know. But no, he was playing it and playing it very well, and everybody was screaming. And I can't understand how he went from that to being, you know, like a solo singer.
Well, I mean, look, Mick Jagger plays the guitar, doesn't he? But he doesn't need to play the guitar in the Stones because he's got Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood to do that for him.
Yes,
he
exactly,
does occasionally get up on stage and strum a bit of guitar. But no, Elvis's act evolved, didn't it? And when he got involved with the so-called Colonel Tom Parker, who decided to market him in a different way as a sex symbol, as somebody whose on-stage moves and his kind of slobbering and flirtatiousness became his hallmarks rather than his ability to play an instrument.
So the emphasis
shifted, didn't it, really?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Apparently what Colonel Parker spotted was the way he used to shake his hips. And Elvis wasn't even aware of this. You know what I mean? The way his legs seemed to be disattached from his rest of his body, and you know, they floated all over the place, and his hips and all that. In fact, he got banned from some states from actually performing because it was deemed to be lewd behaviour. But when Colonel Parker saw that, you're absolutely right. He thought the guitar was getting in the way of Elvis's you know, sexual sort of attraction and all that. And banned him. You're absolutely right. Anyway.
You needed to see the crotch. That was the point, which the guitar kind of sits right there, doesn't it? And that's why that's the whole thing.
The crotch, Miss Jones, this is a family show. When will you see the crotch?
Come on, this is scientific. This is scientific information here, Mike.
Yes.
Think about where, I mean, John Lennon wore his guitar very high on his chest.
He did, didn't he?
He sort of stood there proudly, shoulders back, strumming away, sort of at chest level. Yeah. Most rock stars wear their guitars down around their hips. So, quite frankly, it looks as though they're having a bit of a fiddle when they're actually playing the guitar.
Jones, please, you know, keep it clean. I mean, look, you know, we'll make one more comment about this and then we'll move on to something more family-like. But most guitarists use their guitar like a phallic symbol, don't they?
Exactly. That's what I just said.
Yes. Well, I put it into, you know, plain English, you know, instead of all the innuendos that you tend to, you know, spray
Italian suppositories.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Right. OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, trying to keep some level of decency and dignity in this podcast, you know, despite Miss Jones's innuendos flying around all over the place. But just on that subject, Miss Jones, I'm not going to ask you the direct question, have you ever been a mistress? Because I think that's something you would probably like to keep to yourself. But what do you think of this move to ban the word mistress, okay? The Associated Press, one of the world's biggest international news agencies, their journalists have been told to use alternatives such as friend or companion, but not mistress. There's a big, big difference, isn't there, between a mistress and a friend?
Well, mistress is a pejorative word, isn't it? It has, it hangs with the connotations of something sleazy and untoward.
There you go again. You had to bring in the word hangs, didn't you? You know, when you talk about mistress, I don't know.
Well, that's your dirty mind, not mine.
No. It's at the forefront of your mind, I'm sure. Anyway, please go on.
I think, you know, we can't ban words that already exist because they're out there and people are going to use them. Yes. So if the AP want to ban their journalists using words in copy, for example, somebody's going to read that friend and they say, oh yeah, they mean mistress. That word is still going to kick around.
Yeah, of course it is.
Because unfortunately, in a relationship where, say, for example, the man is married, and this is where the mistress bit comes in because he's having a bit on the side.
Yes.
So the woman generally is younger and not married.
Yes.
And so she's considered to be the naughty one. Whereas he's the one actually, who is committing the sin, the crime, because he's cheating on his wife. That's what it usually means.
Yes.
But then when you've got a situation where both of the naughty parties are married to other people, what is that then? You're not a mistress, are you?
No, I don't know what you are then, to be honest. I suppose you still are a mistress, but what's the bloke called if he's...
Well, then he's a dirty love rat.
Well,
that's the word. Love rat was the word they always used, wasn't it? That was kind of news of the world.
Love rat. A love rat. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I know. It's a terrible word, isn't it?
I mean, but it's kind of a, it's a more descriptive word than mistress, isn't it, really?
It certainly is. Listen, I'm going to tell you about, I read an obituary the other day, okay, and it's about a bloke called George Reynolds, which you will, you'll never have heard of George Reynolds, and most people in the world haven't, but sufficient to say, he got a huge obituary written about him in, believe it or not, the Daily Telegraph. And I always go through the obituary columns because I like reading about Spitfire pilots who were shooting down Messerschmitts at the age of 21 who've just died aged 100. You know what I mean? I have so much respect for the guys who did that. And their stories are always brilliant. You know, the plane was blown up on fire over the English Channel. They bailed out and they were rescued from the water and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, George Reynolds, believe it or not, was a kid who went into an orphanage, you know, when he was about 11. His family were so poor, his mother couldn't keep him from the northeast of England, from somewhere like Sunderland or something like that. He started work in a mine, and he was made a member of the explosives team, because what he had to do is you had to take dynamite down the mine and then knock it into a hole in the wall, and then they blew up the wall, and that's where the coal came from. But he decided to nick a couple of bits of gelignite or dynamite, and he went off and started robbing banks by blowing open the safes. And he got jailed as a bank robber, and he couldn't read or write in prison. But in prison, he learnt to read and write because the prison chaplain sort of took pity on this young boy who'd become a bank robber. He came out of prison, and he decided to start a company making chipboard tops for kitchens, you know, kitchen surfaces, Formica tops and all that. He ended up being 56th on the Sunday Times Rich List with a fortune which would be the equivalent of over 600 million quid these days, and bought Darlington Football Club, which was such a ramshackle operation, the only changing facilities available to the visiting team were a peg on the wall and a hot tub in the middle of the dressing room, which all 11 players had to get in and out of after the game. And he decided he was going to make Darlington into European champions. So he knocked down their stadium and built a brand new 25,000-seater stadium. I mean, how mad is this guy to have done that anyway? But the thing is, he then went bankrupt. It's an amazing story about a bank robber who became a football chief. And I met him several times. He came in and talked to me at Talk Sport, the radio station. Just an amazing bloke. And I do love stories about self-made people.
Yeah, no, he hasn't crossed my radar really, but I'm interested in the fact that he turned himself around. You know, he went to prison and he actually made that into a positive, learned new skills which had evaded him before he was incarcerated, and came out to do things which benefited other people. It just shows us really that we can't write people off for one misdemeanor early on in their lives, because we never really know the circumstances of their previous life that led them into the mire that they found themselves in. But somebody who does manage to turn himself around and reinvent and live a life that's beneficial to others, I think that is exemplary.
Honestly, he came in one time to the studios at Talk Sport, and this young lady came with him, and to say she was vivacious is an understatement. I mean, you know, she had a fantastic figure. She was wearing a tight, short skirt. She,
here we go. This is what impresses the Michael about women.
Well, he was about 60 in those days, right?
You think that's a good thing, that he's flirting around with some floozy?
Now, you see, you're being judgmental. She was described as his personal assistant, okay?
It gets better.
And she had, you know, dark black flowing hair.
God.
But I mean, this guy who came from an orphanage and was a bank robber.
Did the collar match the cuffs is what we need to ask.
I'm sorry?
Did the collar match the cuffs?
Did the collar match the cuffs? I don't really get that one, Miss Jones, but I'll leave that to the imagination, shall I? But when he came in, I said, hi, George, have you come down from the northeast today? He says, no, we're at our place in Hampstead. He had a £3 million house in Hampstead. He had a place in the south of France. He had a yacht. I mean, it's just a fantastic story. Anyway, look, not to bore everybody about George Reynolds, but George Reynolds has died. Rest in peace. Now,
R.I.P. indeed, yes.
Yes, indeed. What was that?
R.I.P.
R.I.P., yes, absolutely, thank you. Now, Jimmy Osmond is 58. How about that? I'll be your long-haired lover from Liverpool. I mean, that was the most awful and ridiculous number one record we've ever had in this country, wasn't it?
So did you have to sing it to us?
Well, I thought I'd just give you I exercise my vocal cords in most of these podcasts, Miss Jones, and the audience expect it.
Yes, I absolutely agree. But, I mean, what a terrible hit that was. Who bought that record and who got it to number one? Because I never had it in my record collection.
I didn't either. You're absolutely right. That's a great question. Who would be mad enough to have gone and spent their 7 shillings and 6 pence in those days, whatever a 45 cost, to buy I'll be your long-haired lover from Liverpool, you be my Romelu.
He wasn't even cute, was he? He wasn't Michael Jackson. No. Michael Jackson at the age of 8 or 9 was deliciously cute.
And, yeah, you're right.
And we couldn't get enough of him. But Jimmy Osmond, I'm sorry to say, was this kind of squat-faced little fat thing, wasn't he?
He was the fat kid. He was the fat...
Yeah, he was the fat kid. Maybe that was it. People felt sorry for him.
Yeah, he was the fat youngest brother of the, you know, the legendary Osmonds and all that they stood for, introduced on the Andy Williams show as a... But the thing is that the Osmonds, I think they started off as 4, didn't they? Then they became 5. Then Jimmy came along and they were 6. And then what was the name of the sister?
Marie and Donnie did, was it Paper Roses?
Paper Roses.
Oh, yes, she couldn't say
they
her Os.
They were only. And the other one they did was, the one she did was, I remember... And he lived on the silver side of the mountain, and I lived on the other side of the hill or something.
It was all a bit weird because they came across, the way they sang to each other on stage and on record, it came across like they were sort of in love with each other. And that was odd because they were brother and sister.
Yes, that's true.
So that it was it had a very uncomfortable feel to it. But I can tell you quite a good Osmond story.
Oh, yeah.
For many years... Our family was tormented by the idea that we were related to them.
What? You're related?
Absolutely. And my aunties, my Welsh aunties, you know, they'd all get round the Christmas tree every December and one Cinzano and tonic too many. And the stories would start to come out how we were related to the Osmonds. Because the Osmonds on their mother's side came from Merthyr in South Wales, where my family came from as well.
Right.
And they were the... of that generation that went out to Utah in the States and founded the Mormon movement over there, you see.
Yeah.
But they could trace their ancestors right back to the same line as my ancestors in Merthyr. So I was able to rock up. Donnie Osmond came back to Merthyr and they made a film that was on the BBC some years ago about his return to his roots when he came back to South Wales.
Yes.
And he gave a concert at MacArthur Castle in that area of South Wales.
Yes.
And I was able to go along to the concert, turn up backstage to his dressing room and utter the immortal words, "You know we're related, don't you?"
Celebrity
dreads.
And what was his response?
Well, he just had this look of horror on his face, as if to say, "This is going to cost me millions."
Yeah.
But no, I was teasing him, really.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where the rumour started, but it was a good one, and it fueled the family for many years, yeah.
A great story. I remember when I was working on the Chester Chronicle, the Osmonds hit their peak and Donny hit his peak, and I remember getting the bus into town one night, you know, going out on the lash with a load of pals going to the King's Disco in Chester, and all these little girls were at the back of the bus who got on at the council housing estate, the stop before mine, and on the back of the bus, honestly, they were all singing, "And they called it puppy love."
Oh, my God.
Because that was Donnie's big hit. Listen, what you've just said about, the brother and sister, uneasy feeling, that just kicks something off in my head about how I felt very uneasy about a Frank Sinatra record once. And it was when he duetted with Nancy of These Boots Are Made for Walking fame, and they sung, "And then I go and ruin it all by saying something stupid like I love you." And I felt very uneasy about father and daughter singing a song with those lyrics.
I did as well. I had exactly the same thoughts. Really? So it wasn't just my sleazy mind. It was yours as well, and probably millions of other people.
Yeah.
It was a very odd thing. I'm sure, you know, the intention was lovely. Yeah. Father and daughter love each other so much. But it was sang as a love song.
It was, yeah. I know.
And it came across like a little bit untoward. There was something uncomfortable about it.
Well, don't you think in the whole of the music industry, somebody else would have just sort of asked the question and said, hang on, you want us to put this out? It's clearly a love song. It's between two people. So had it been Frank Sinatra and, I don't know, Shirley Bassey, maybe, or something like that, you know, in those days, then you could have, you know, you could have really marketed it, couldn't you? You know, with a video of them staring into each other's eyes and that kind of stuff. I never understood that.
No, I didn't either. But I think what it was, they were on a mission to launch Nancy as a massive star. And actually, it worked. She was a massive star for a while with Boots,
she sang
as you say.
She sang one of the Bond songs. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, I can't remember either.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. A friend of mine in the music industry contacted me only a week or so ago and said, you need to write a biography about Nancy Sinatra. And I said, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, she's over. My kids wouldn't even know who she is.
Well, one chapter would cover her life anyway, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. He's going, no, she's still a really big star. The name Sinatra. But I think the fact that he's of the older generation, he still remembers her as an artist and how big she was. And I think there's a bit of nostalgia ruling that there for him. I don't think any publisher would buy from me a biography about Nancy Sinatra.
No, I totally agree. I tell you, who might be worth a book. And the reason I say this is because he was born on this day in 1947, but sadly is no longer with us. And that's Jerry Rafferty. Because if there's ever a classic single from the whole of my life, outside of everything I love about the Beatles, that I would say that is probably the greatest song ever, it would be Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty. And I reckon a lot of that is to do with the opening sax intro. One of the most iconic sounds, I think, in the history of pop music, yeah?
Yeah, do you know who that saxophonist was?
No, but you will, I bet.
Sure, it's a guy called Raff Ravenscroft.
Yeah.
He's also dead. Jerry's dead. Raff died shortly after him, actually. I think Jerry died 2011. Raff must have died 2014. But it is one of the most iconic sax solos in the history of rock and pop music. Can you tell me the name of the other one?
No. Oh, sorry. That's... What? Talking about sax?
The other great famous sax solo, yes.
Blimey. I could if I spent time, but we don't have time, Ms. Jones, so please tell me.
Well, that is, of course, Careless Whisper, George Michael.
Oh, yes,
and
of course.
I think a lot of people think it's the same saxophonist on those two tracks, but in fact, it was a guy called Steve Gregory who played the sax intro on Careless Whisper. He was the 11th, can you believe, sax player to record that solo. So particular was George Michael about the sound that he wanted, even at that young age. And they were lining up outside the studio and he was sacking them one by one. And then number 11 was Steve Gregory and off they went.
That's amazing. So George Michael, probably still in his 20s, guy comes in with his saxophone, right, play this. And he says straight to his face, yeah, OK, thanks very much. Don't ring us, we'll ring you. Out. And the next guy comes in. That's an amazing story.
Absolute total commitment to the sound in his head.
Yeah.
And don't forget, he wrote Careless Whisper on the bus on his way to a DJing gig when he was about 16.
Well, you love those stories, don't you? You really do.
I do. I really do.
Right. Now then, yes, absolutely. Now, the weather's getting a bit better, Miss Jones. That's good for if you want to go out to a pub garden and enjoy a drink. I did actually have a walk across the Downs yesterday and I did stop at a place and I had a couple of pints of beer, but it's still a bit cold. Now, if it's cold and you want to make yourself warm, do you have a hot tub in your roof garden, Miss Jones?
No, I absolutely don't have a hot tub. I think they're disgusting things. That's like sitting in a toilet with a bunch of people, isn't it?
Well,
you know, nobody has a wash before they get in those things. So they're all sweaty and grimy. In they get.
Yeah.
These things are not self-filtering. And you all sit there in other people's filth, all bubbling around. I think they're gross things.
I'd never quite thought of it like that. But now that you say, but the reason I raise it is because there's a crime wave going on. Hot tub thefts will be this year's crime wave. Thieves are getting themselves into hot water, but perhaps not in the way police would like. Britain is suffering a rising number of hot tub thefts, with people creeping into gardens and stealing the pools. I mean, I just don't get it. It must take ages to sort of undo all the plumbing from a hot tub, because you don't just pour the water in. They're, you know, they're plumbed up to something. But I agree with you. The idea of sitting there and all bubbling away and all that is pretty disgusting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's gross. How do you steal a hot tub? I mean, they're massive things, you know. Not one person could lift it up. And as you say, you've got to de-plumb it before you can carry it out. I don't get that at all.
No, I don't. I just don't understand the story. A, why would you want to steal a hot tub? They're not really that expensive. B, as you quite rightly say, you've got to unplumb it. C, you've got to get it away from the premises. But D, you've just made the point, like somebody else has been swilling around in that hot tub, you know, for probably weeks, months. And would you want it anyway? No, I do not think so.
Don't you think it's a thing? Like, people used to steal garden gnomes. That was a thing for a while, wasn't it?
Maybe.
It's just that kind of joke of stealing something so undesirable, really.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I just don't get it. Some things in life are completely inexplicable. Now, I said that I came across a documentary on Elvis Presley. Another programme I looked in on BBC Two, actually, in the last couple of days, was Elizabeth Taylor, A Life in 10 Pictures. Now, you know quite a lot about this series, of course, because you've starred in one, haven't you?
Well, I took part in the documentary about Freddie Mercury, but yes, it's the same series.
Yeah.
So it's called In 10 Pictures, and they re-examine the life of a particular celebrity through a series of 10 photographs per episode. And the one on Saturday night was Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? I just thought that Elizabeth Taylor was fated as one of the greatest Hollywood stars ever because she was just so incredibly beautiful, you know? We were talking about mistresses earlier in this. She became Richard Burton's mistress, didn't she? And it caused great scandal when they were filming together in Rome or something like that. But what I didn't realise is Elizabeth Taylor won 2 Oscars. There's not many actresses walking the earth who've got 2 Oscars, are there?
No, and do you know which film she won them for?
It wasn't National Velvet, which was her first one. In fact, actually, I didn't recognise the names of the films, but you can remind me, of course.
They were Butterfield 8 in 1961, in which she played a call girl. And then in 1967, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah.
But the thing she was famous for, and this was a shame because it overshadowed her on-screen, incendiary, unforgettable presence, was her affair with Burton and subsequent 2 marriages to him.
Yes.
It was this chemistry that they had that just rumpled up the film. You know, you couldn't actually follow a story because you were watching this incredible chemistry between these two.
Yeah.
And it was undeniable to the pair of them. They both left their relationships for each other. And then, of course, they couldn't live without each other, but they couldn't live with each other. And it was very explosive off screen as well as on. And they got divorced and then they got married again. I think it just captivated the imagination of the world, really. That I can't think of another male-female relationship among celebrities that has quite captured the imagination the way they did.
Well, it was way before our time, but what about Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall?
Yeah, well, there was that. Yeah, but as you say, way before our time.
Yeah, that's right.
I did know Lauren Bacall a bit. I met her on a film set somewhere in America years ago when I was on the circuit. And she was very fierce, but she liked me. We struck up a little bit of a friendship and she gave me a card. She said, next time you're in New York, because I was there very often in those days, she said, come up and see me sometime. She actually said that line. She lived in the Dakota building.
Smile. Yeah, you told me that.
Yeah, she lived there.
Yeah.
And I did go up to the Dakota where, of course, John and Yoko were also living.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I had tea with her. She didn't age well, but tremendously good-looking women tend not to. And Liz Taylor was the same.
Yeah.
You saw some footage of her in her later life. She had a lot of health problems.
Yeah, wheelchair.
Yeah, she did have lots of surgery.
Heavy. I mean, the thing is, if you want to keep looking good when you get beyond 50 or 60, you have to start pumping Botox into your face. Otherwise, your face becomes lined, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't think you need to do that. I think you just need to withdraw from the public eye and let the mythology of your earlier life do the talking. I think that's the answer.
I think that's a great way to do it. Just getting back to Burton very briefly, of course, he died of drink. I remember reading a review of some play he was in London, and he was out on the piss all day with Peter O'Toole, who wasn't working, but Burton was. And after about 5 minutes of this stage play, they had to drop the curtain because Burton was so pissed, you know, he couldn't get his words out and he was staggering all over the place. And about 3 weeks later, he just died. He'd become a chronic alcoholic and just drank all day. But if you're going to go, quite frankly, I think that's not a bad way to go.
Well, you can say that, but it is a waste. It's a bit like George Best, isn't it? A waste of your talent, your attributes, your personality, all those things. My father idolised Richard Burton. He absolutely worshipped him.
Really?
They came from the same part of the world.
Of course,
and
Wales,
I think, you know, Welsh boyo done good. It was always that. Anthony Hopkins was another one.
That's right,
who
yeah.
came from that part of the world too. But it was a tragedy. People like to say that he never got over the loss of Elizabeth. But then, you know...
But they were both trumps, weren't they? They were both trumps.
Yes, they were. You've got to live with a person to really know what they're like.
Sure. And also, I think that Burton had a problem with the success of Elizabeth Taylor and her worldwide fame and all that, in the same way that Prince Charles had a problem with Diana. You know what I mean? It's a male ego thing. Suddenly, if your partner, who's a woman in life, is fated to an even greater extent than you are, it's hard to handle.
I think it was harder for Charles because he was destined to be king. Yeah. So, you know, the most important person in forever. And he was eclipsed by this chit of a thing who was brought in as a sort of, you know, make-do wife and mother of future heirs. But he was really in love with another woman and he expected to be able to carry on that affair on the side. That she also, Camilla, was married to someone else, and he couldn't understand why the media fell for Diana the way they did, or the way we did, I should say.
No, it's just absolutely true. Absolutely true. Righto, Miss Jones, well, thank you very much indeed. I hope you have a good week. I hope we all have a good week. We're only a month away now from the pubs opening altogether. So next time you have one of those lovely lunches, you won't have to stand outside a restaurant round a table. You'll be able to do the Fleet Street run before arriving at the restaurant. Something I hope I'll be doing with you, Miss Jones.
We are so going to do that, and I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah. In fact, I'm in training right now.
Good. I'm good. I'm glad to hear it. Right. OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for having joined myself and Leslie and today, and we'll be back with you very soon. Stay safe, folks.
You needed to see the crotch. That was the point, which the guitar kind of sits right there, doesn't it? And that's why... That's the whole thing
crotch,
of rocks.
Miss Jones, this is a family show. When will you see the
crotch? Come on, this is scientific. This is scientific information here, Mike.
Yes,
think about where, I mean, John Lennon wore his guitar very high on his chest.
He did, didn't
remember.
He? Yeah.
He sort of stood there proudly, shoulders back, strumming away, sort of at chest level. Yeah. Most rock stars wear their guitars down around their hips. So, quite frankly, it looks as though they're having a bit of a fiddle when they're actually playing the guitar.
Jones, please, you know, keep it clean. I mean, look, you know, we'll make one more comment about this and then we'll move on to something more family-like. But most guitarists use their guitar like a phallic symbol, don't they?
Exactly. That's what I just said.
You know, she had a fantastic figure. She was wearing a tight, short skirt. She,
here we go. This is what impresses the Michael about women.
Well, he was about 60 in those days, right? Because
you think that's a good thing? Well, that he's flirting around with some floozy?
Now, you see, you're being judgmental. She was described as his personal assistant, okay?
It gets better.
And she had, you know, dark black flowing hair and...
God.
But I mean, this guy who came from an orphanage and was a...
Did the collar match the calf is what we need to ask.
I'm sorry? I mean, the thing is, if you want to keep looking good when you get beyond 50 or 60, you have to start pumping Botox into your face. Otherwise, your face becomes lined, doesn't it?